One Democratic state senator lost his job last week while the legislature works out budget issues. Ben Bradford updates those stories and the ongoing fallout of sexual harassment by lawmakers in this week's Capitol Chat. A Yippies Day at Disneyland is coming to B Street Theater. It's based on an actual event that happened in the summer of 1970. Today, we'll talk about that show. Rituals of Mine is headlining at the R Street Get Down this Saturday. It's a free, all-ages block party and a special hometown performance for singer Tara Lopez. And for this week's Sound Advice, we're previewing the Davis Music Festival. The festival features 40 bands this weekend, including a few Insight Music veterans. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. A little more than 1 week has passed since the June primary election, and California politicians are still riding the waves of the fallout while finalizing the state budget. For today's Capitol Chat, we're checking in with Ben Bradford, state government reporter and host of Cap Radio's Keys to the House podcast. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
So on your latest episode of Keys to the House, you had some political strategists interpret the results of last week's primary election for a preview of the November general. What are some of the key issues both parties are watching?
Yeah, well, you know, the big concern for Democrats was that there are all of these potentially competitive congressional races in what's long held Republican territory. But because of California's unusual top two primary system, where it doesn't matter what party you are, however many votes you get, the top two vote getters, regardless of party, advance the general election. And Democrats were concerned that in a few of these races, they could get locked out where they would have two Republicans advance the general election. Not because Republicans would necessarily get enough votes that, you know, they would just but because the Democratic vote would get split among multiple candidates. So that didn't happen. In a couple of districts, it was very, very close, but it looks increasingly clear. We still have some ballots coming in that there will be a Democrat versus a Republican in all of these really key races. There was one race where Republicans could have potentially gotten locked out. And so, you know, I think parties are still kind of reckoning with how do they campaign in a top two system. I mean, you even saw this in the governor's race where the sort of strategy for Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa was to kind of get into the top two, realizing that he probably wasn't going to get ahead of Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. So instead vying for that second spot. And that spectacularly did not work out with Republican candidate John Cox really securing that. So that was one thing we were looking at. The other thing is just turnout. Because, you know, the Democrats have been hoping that enthusiasm in California against President Trump would drive voters to the polls. There are about 6 million ballots counted so far with about a little over another million left. Turnout's likely going to be around 38%, which, you know, it's a midterm primary. They tend to have lower turnout, but it's probably not what Democrats were hoping for. It's probably better news for Republicans. I mean, just that there's not a huge sign of major turnout. So those are a couple of things we were looking at.
Is there an issue that is uniting the GOP this cycle in California?
So the big thing that Republicans are hoping is going to drive enthusiasm for their side and drive turnout is the gas tax. And especially repealing this this gas tax increase, 12 cents a gallon, that went into effect in November, that was part of this transportation funding bill, major package that Governor Jerry Brown kind of cobbled together with lawmakers last year. And Republicans successfully recalled State Senator Josh Newman. It breaks the what would otherwise likely be a supermajority for Democrats in the legislature. They recalled Josh Newman, who had won a longtime Republican seat back in 2016. And the message of that recall, the reason for the recall, was the gas tax.
So we have a piece of tape from one Democratic strategist at this point. This is Katie Merrill, and here's what she had to say about the opposition to that gas tax.
So I always say California is a little more purple than people realize, particularly when it comes to ballot measures. So the gas tax, and particularly on tax measures, we are very purple. So this gas tax measure, and especially based on the results in the Orange County recall, is going to increase Republican turnout, and that could be problematic for us in taking back these seats.
Were Democrats expecting that kind of backlash to be this severe?
I mean, I think that, you know, if you talk to Katie, for instance, you just heard, you know, she was disappointed by that. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, Josh Newman, about almost 60% of voters voted to recall him. That's a pretty big number in a district that was very, very close. He narrowly won back in 2016. So, you know, it's something that that both parties are really closely watching. It's going to be a huge deal. Look for this to be sort of the main message from Republicans. There's a ballot measure that that John Cox, the Republican candidate for governor, has funded that is essentially to repeal that gas tax. That's going to be on the ballot in November. So all of these, you know, kind of issues in general, this is going to be the one to watch.
So you brought up Senator Josh Newman, and he was recalled, as you said, last week. Was this unique to this district, or could it spell out a bigger trend in the state? First, let's listen to a little bit of tape. We have political analyst Paul Mitchell on the recall. Let's check that out.
He won the general election in what most people considered a pretty shocking upset of Lingling Chang. And it was carried through because of the, you know, Orange County turning Democratic for the first time, this big wave election we had in the 16 presidential with huge Democratic and young voter turnout. And that swept him into office. Now, once he gets to Sacramento, he is target number one.
So let me just kind of unpack that a little bit. Basically, Mitchell is saying that he is skeptical that the gas that you can say from the recall of Josh Newman that the gas tax is the reason that Newman was so kind of overwhelmingly recalled. Because essentially he's saying, look, Newman won very closely in 2016, which was a November general election in a presidential year. And if you look at just the sort of general cycles of the way that turnout works, and so much of elections is based on these kind of like fundamental dynamics of who's going to show up to the polls, given the kind of race that it is. You know, Democrats tend to turn out much more in presidential years and particularly in general elections. In midterm years, Republicans tend to have kind of a steadier presence. So while the Democratic vote kind of swings up and down, the Republican vote holds pretty steady. And so Mitchell is saying, look, the gas tax was the sort of the reason, the justification for doing the recall. But he's saying the actual election and what we saw from it and the turnout has, to him, more to do with just the fundamental dynamics. It was a primary election in a midterm year. Republicans tend to turn out more for those. So I don't know that he's saying necessarily that the gas tax won't be a big issue. We know it will be. And certainly it'll be just even if it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy, mm-hmm. because, you know, people are looking at the recall and saying, wow, that worked. So now that's going to be a major focus, or because it does work. But either way, he's saying that it's the in this instance, you can't necessarily draw that conclusion. It's more of a correlation rather than causation.
I'm talking with Cap Radio state government reporter Ben Bradford for this week's Capital Chat. So one story that we were tracking last week was the possibility of one party being shut out in key races. And you've touched on that a little bit under this top two primary system. But that didn't happen. So why not? And were we overestimating that quirky aspect of the top two system?
Yeah, I think that it depends. So if you know, Paul Mitchell, who we just heard from,
right.
Who's this data analyst, you know, he's one of the two major companies that provides voting data to both parties and to campaigns from both parties. He would tell you it's unlikely. If you listen to our show and you listen to our episode titled "The Dem on Dem Factor," we go pretty well into it. And he says, look, you know, there's sort of a whole bunch of things that have to happen, but when you sort of replicate that over multiple races, then it becomes more likely. Now, to me, it looks like if you look at some of these races, for instance, the Orange County race where Dana Rohrabacher is a Republican congressman who's the incumbent. And Rohrabacher is not all that popular. He only got about 30% of the vote, despite being in Congress since the 1980s. There was another, you know, very well-known or relatively well-known Republican running in that race named Scott Baugh. Among Democrats, there were multiple Democrats running that race, many of whom were well-funded and who have much less name recognition. So you think about that, and you have this possibility of the vote splitting between, on the Republican side, just Rohrabacher and Baugh, and on the Democratic side, splitting between multiple candidates. And when you carve it up that way, there was a real possibility of a lockout. It didn't end up happening I haven't looked at the numbers, the latest numbers, but it was very, very close. We're talking, you know, within 1,000 votes for quite a long time. It's probably just outside of that now. All you would need is a slight adjustment for that to have been a lockout. So that's really, you know, for Democrats, kind of like by the skin of their teeth. And they spent hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars attacking Scott Baugh, bumping up their candidates. At one point, the DCCC, which is the campaign arm for Congress, even spent money to support a Republican candidate who was further down the ballot, a lesser known one who they knew did not have a chance to win, just because they wanted to pull Republican votes from Baugh. So, you know, that's sort of the factors that made it so there was not a lockout.
So how are the national political figures factoring into all these scenarios, including, of course, President Trump and other high profile Dems?
Well, for Democrats, you know, if the gas tax is going to be the key Republican issue that they're going to look to focus on, President Trump is going to be the key issue for Democrats. Right. And essentially making the argument that in the congressional races that we're following, that, you know, Republican members of Congress are kind of in lockstep with Trump, who is very unpopular in California. And so he's going to have an oversized presence. I mean, you saw, I think, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom on Twitter saying, yeah, Trump, please come campaign in California. And, you know, on the other side, you're just going to see a lot of money from national groups because, you know, sort of the whole premise of our podcast and the reason there's so much concentration on California is because, you know, if Democrats are 23 seats shy of having a majority control of Congress. So Republicans are trying to hold on to those 23 seats. In California, there are 7 districts where Hillary Clinton won that Donald Trump lost in 2016. And so if you think about that, that means that if that suggests, and maybe it does and maybe it doesn't, that those seats are kind of vulnerable or up for grabs, there's the examples of Democrats winning those districts at least in some way, well, that's a third of the ones that are going to be the battlegrounds to determine which party controls the House. And that's a huge deal because, you know, it's right now we have United Republican control. And if Democrats won the House, not only would you see that, but, you know, if you remember sort of when President Obama was in office and Republicans won control of the House, you had Daryl Issa, who's one of the most embattled. He's retired, but his district is one of the biggest battlegrounds now. But you remember all the investigations, whether it was into Benghazi or Fast and Furious or the IRS potentially targeting Republican groups. All of those kinds of things are investigations that came from Republicans having a majority in the House.
So let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about the state budget process. Where are we in that?
So we're expecting a vote later today on the state budget. And, you know, I think sometimes people's eyes roll back in their head when they hear, oh, the budget. But, you know, the reason this matters is because this is the biggest bill that the legislature will pass in a year, and you're looking at it just by the amount of money. This is a $200 billion budget that decides what is the state going to spend, you know, your money on. So, yeah, we're expecting that vote later today. And, you know, then Brown has to sign it by, you know, the constitutional mandate to pass it is tomorrow, and then Brown has to sign it. So that's where we're at.
And so before we let you go, are there any updates to the fallout to the sexual harassment stories we've been tracking for the past few months?
Yeah. Well, so the most recent thing is that Christina Garcia, the assemblywoman who a Democratic assemblywoman who was one of the people in Time magazine with the woman of the year being the silence breakers. And there were actually sexual harassment allegations against her. There was an investigation. The allegations of sexual harassment weren't substantiated. There were other ones about her being abusive to staff and using, you know, vulgar language with them and so forth that were substantiated. The person who made some of the sexual harassment allegations, that his lawyer appealed, and the assembly has now reopened that one. So that's going to be something that we're watching as well.
So this is an ongoing case, and that's not done.
Not done yet, apparently.
Okay. Well, Ben Bradford, thank you for coming in, being on Insight today. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Have a great day.
You too.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ryak. The B Street Theater hosts an intensive 10-month internship program for young actors to learn their craft. At the end of the program, the intern company puts on a program that's produced and performed by that year's intern class. This year, the B Street Intern Company presents A Yippie's Day at Disneyland, about one activist protester's decision whether or not to cooperate with the FBI and betray her friends. We have with us today Olivia Shopper-John, one of this year's acting interns, playing the role of Louise Sawyer. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining her is the playwright of this work, artistic associate and intern coordinator, Sean Patrick Nill. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, Sean, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the backstory to this play. How much of it is based on real events, and where did your artistic impulse take over on this?
The artistic impulse happened because we needed a play, and the interns basically came to me and said, we're supposed to do this. And I said, oh, yeah. So I was driving home with my girlfriend, and we were listening to a podcast, Memory Palace, and one of the episodes is an invasion of Tom Sawyer's Island. And it was all about that protest in Disneyland and kind of the disappointing numbers and also the attempts to protest Vietnam and how no one paid attention to it. And so I thought it would be a really fascinating conflict and really interesting moment in history to kind of reflect on. And then the story is, it's based on real events, but the character of Louise Sawyer is fictional. And it's kind of a way in to create someone new and with a specific conflict, but also talk about the Yippie movement, which sadly a lot of people don't remember anymore. And it was a really unique group of people.
So, Olivia, how did you prepare for this role? What did you do to get then to the character as Louise Sawyer?
Well, I was talking to my grandpa one day. And he's in his 60s, and so he remembers the Yippies. And so I was talking to him a little bit about that, which was kind of helpful, actually. It wasn't planned at all. It just was a casual conversation. And then I talked to Sean a lot about it, listened to the podcast he talked about. And then I'm working with Kurt Johnson, who's one of the company members, is our director. And so I talked a lot about, you know, how... what the culture was like, you know? I mean, it was completely different. You know, it was going towards living your day to the fullest and making sure that you're trying to save these people that you don't even see or know, and you don't have video conferences like we do now. It's just all over telephone, you know? And so a lot of it was just living freely. And you know, I don't really know what that's like because I am a young 20-something in the 2000s. So just getting into the time period was mostly what I did, looking up time period stuff.
And Sean, you wrote this piece, obviously, with Olivia in mind. what about your time working with her, convinced that she would be good for the role? And how did you kind of shape that character with Olivia?
Yeah, well, one of the really unique transitions that's happened with the internship is originally it was mostly acting interns with a couple of stage management interns and, you know, maybe a tech and design intern here and there. And we've really expanded it and have sized down the acting internship. We've been much more specific about who we choose, so they get more, as much experience as possible. And so Olivia is actually the only acting intern right now. And one of the things that she has done a great job of is really take on how to be comfortable in her body, how to convey a objective and a conflict without getting into too much other nonsense. And then the fun thing really is that, you know, we have Saturday classes and with Buck Busfield and myself, and Buck was really able to work with her with character and really kind of put her in characters that she isn't necessarily something that comes easy for her, and something that, and she just excelled so well. And so I knew that she could play this role, and, you know, she's a goofball. And so I just said, well, you know, let's give you a character that's really, you know, just has no inhibitions and wants to, you know, is excited and doesn't care about the hierarchy or what she's supposed to do, quote unquote. And, you know, I think she's done a really, really great job with it.
Is that challenging to write a show with one character?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, originally it was a one-person show. And then Kurt Johnson came to me and said, we have about 3 weeks to do this. There's no way she's going to memorize all this. And it really helped. We have Amy Kelly is making a special appearance in this show.
She doth protest.
Yes, I doth protest too much. Yeah.
We have a lot of, Emmanuel Jimenez is playing one of the roles. And Amy Kelly is, who's one of our most popular acting company members. She's making special appearances. And so it's been a really fun thing because the interns get to interact with company members and get to, you know, collaborate together to make a brand new piece of theater, which is rare and mm-hmm. always a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
So that must be exciting for you. Let's talk a little bit about how you've grown with this program after 10 months working for B Street.
Well, I'll say I joined this company. The reason I was really interested in this internship is it experiments a lot with improvisational theater. And that's something that I've always really enjoyed and I've never been good at. So I was like, let me try it. Let's see what happens. I in college and in high school, I was always cast in classical theater because of the way I look. And I also just could convey it because I have good breast support. So they're like, put her as insert page number here, right? And so when Lindsay Birch gave me the internship, I was interested in that. And then I was also just interested in new works, you know? And so when Sean wrote this piece and I read it for the first time, I was so nervous. I was so nervous because normally I play the ingenue that has no cares in the life. And Louise just has constant problems, back to back to back to back to back, just constant conflict.
So is this an anxiety-driven character?
Yes, 100%. But she doesn't like to admit she has anxiety, right?
Which causes a
lot of humor that Kurt and I had a really fun time kind of sculpting. And what I've learned a lot by watching Amy Kelly work is Amy Kelly, you know, you see her in all these really comedic roles and everything, but she does this role that's extremely dramatic and is just beautiful to watch. She just throws something at you and you can either choose to catch it or just let it go by you because she just changes constantly. And then Kurt, we've just had a fun time figuring out what I would do in the situation and then making it more grounded, which has been easier for me to do than I thought it was going to be, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
That's Olivia Shopperjohn. She is the lead role in the one-woman play, although I guess it's not a one-character play.
It's a one-character-centered play.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It is A Yippie's Day at Disneyland. That's the title of the show. Joining her is the playwright here with us, of course, Sean Patrick Neal. And they are performing the work at the B Street Theater Intern Showcase on June 18th with two shows, 6:30 and 8:30. So, Sean, we just heard Olivia reflect a little bit on her internship experience. And you were once a B Street intern.
Yes.
Now you're the intern coordinator. Mm-hmm. You're in charge.
Yes.
What does the B Street internship offer these young actors and that draw so much talent to Sacramento?
I think one of the aspects of the internship that is really great is we are focused on introducing professional theater to someone who has just come from an educational atmosphere. So for us, we take away the, I don't want to say safety net, but it's this thing of, you know, we don't have all the time in the world to really, you know, say, hey, well, you know, let's reflect on this for 2 weeks and then, you know, and then you can try it. It's
so no group hugs, huh?
Group hugs, definitely. Group hugs. But it's group hugs and then, okay, what's next?
Okay.
You know, it's
constant bowl rolling.
Yeah, it's something where, you know, we put them in the heart of a professional theater. And one of the things that it's really great and what I tell interns all the time is you get to learn how a professional theater operates and figure out how to fill in the gaps that a professional theater needs. Which is something that it takes years for most actors out of college to learn. Mm-hmm. And we do it in 8 to 10 months. And more than anything, you get to have the experience of creating new works.
Yeah.
You get to do school tours, which
school tours are
great. You know, it's 12 weeks with the hardest audience you can imagine, kindergartners through 8th graders.
Oh, boy.
And keeping them focused on
an
audience.
Yeah, yeah. An original collective of original short plays. And you really understand, you know, the difference between I feel good about this and is this good?
Mm-hmm. So true.
And so it's a really important internship. And plus, the other great things is, you know, we offer equity cards to our acting interns and stage management interns should they choose to take them, which often takes years for people to acquire. And then, you know, just to have that intimate relationship with our staff, both artistic and administrative and tech crew, and to, you know, really learn with hands-on about how to do things. Mm-hmm.
So, Olivia, what is next for you now that you've been through this internship experience? Any long-term goals in the pipeline?
Oh, my goodness, that's a great question. Well, I'm actually doing a regional theater job in Indiana. I'm playing Little Red and Into the Woods. So I get to do that, and I'm doing a children's show, which will be great. But I'm actually going to come back, and I'm doing a show here with B Street when I come back. I don't know, goals-wise, I would love to do some film, get my feet in that. I love doing film. I actually did some monologues for Tim when he was in town, Tim Buzzfield, and that was really fun. And he was telling me that I should try it, just go for it.
Yeah.
So I think I might try some of that.
Olivia and Sean, thank you for joining us on Insight today.
Thank you,
Beth.
That is Olivia Shopperjohn and Sean Patrick Nill with the B Street Theater. A Yippie's Day at Disneyland will be presented at the Internship Showcase on June 18th with two shows at 6:30 and 8:30. We have more information on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Dreams leave you soaking in the darkness and sweating through your sheets. You're on the shores of tomorrow, but land is just out of reach. You're a sailor, not a soldier, so keep floating out to sea. Oh. You're a body of water from your head down to your feet. There's a current of fire pushing land from underneath. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. This Saturday on R Street and 14th, there will be a free all-ages block party with live music and food. The headliner this weekend is Rituals of Mine, led by singer Tara Lopez. Tara has been very busy with touring, writing new music, and working on a multimedia art installation project. But she has taken a few minutes out of her schedule to catch us up and preview the show. Tara, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. So we need to start out with a little catch-up. You released Devoted in the summer of 2015, and things have accelerated from there. So let us know what's going on.
Yeah, so we released Devoted, and now we're working on new material. It's been kind of a whirlwind of touring for the last couple of years, and gosh, so much has been going on.
Yeah, and you've relocated as well. You're living in Los Angeles?
Yes, it's actually been a year this month, and it's been really beautiful, and it's just kept me busy. I've been so busy.
And a big deal, you've signed.
Yeah, we signed to Warner Brothers. That has been an incredible experience, and it's just been it's been really great. I've also been venturing in with my own record label, and that's been really incredible. And, you know, I'm just learning a lot.
Have you been surprised by your success?
You know, I don't really think about it, to be honest. I just have my head in work constantly, and I have so many goals that I've yet to achieve. So I'm very grateful for any of the success that I've had so far, but I'm always looking forward.
And so now you're going to hop across the Atlantic.
Yeah. Yeah. For the first time. I've never toured overseas. And that still feels surreal to me. I'm so excited. So grateful for that opportunity.
Let's listen to one of the tracks off your album. This is Ride or Die.
All I want is a ride or die. All I want is a ride or die. I was ageless at age 18. Lying on my back and learn how to daydream. You're constant, a constant doubt in my head, my mind, a refrain of reverie. I can't explain your person embedded in my teeth, hair tangled in between. Space around me drops out and shuts down my speech. I'm floating, I'm lovely, it's approaching. Holy shit, encroaching. I embody the only one I could dare to be with. Oh, what have I done? All I want is a
ride. Tell us what that song is about, Ride or Die.
You know, it's really just about having people in your life that have your back, whether it's in a romantic sense or your friendships, which I have always really valued in my life. So really, and also just being that for yourself.
Have you found that?
I think so. Yeah, I found it, you know, really it's about learning myself. That record was really about figuring out who I am, what I want. I found an incredible partner that I've been with for 3 years, and she's been just through it all with me. So definitely, I didn't expect to find that, but I'm grateful that I did.
How does it feel to return to your hometown? Sacramento is changing. What are you seeing about being here at this time?
Oh, wow. It's definitely changed. I stayed at the Kimpton Sawyer for 2 nights on my first 2 nights here. And that is a completely new area. I remember being a teenager and having, you know, Joe Sun on K Street and the record shop there. And so it's pretty wild. It feels like a brand new life for the city. And I think in a lot of ways, that's really great. Yeah, it's definitely changed just over the last year since I've been back.
Are you seeing an energy in the music scene?
I am, yeah. I'm finding that a lot of people that I talk to, a lot of the artists that I talk to are saying that there's more resources, which I think is incredible and very much needed.
You've founded Bitch Wave Records, that which you were talking about, your own label,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah,
yeah. And what is your mission with your own label?
I really want to provide a place where artists can feel supported and heard. And, you know, through my various experiences, I think it's really needed, especially for marginalized artists, people of color, the queer community. And so that's really what I'm trying to do with my friend Lauren Ross. We've kind of, you know, we're in the very early stages trying to just set, the foundation for that. But we have big plans, big goals. And so I just want to help people as much as I can.
I'm speaking with Tara Lopez, one half of the electronic duo Rituals of Mine. They are headlining the R Street Get Down this Saturday. So tell me what it feels like about the project, how it started. This is what it feels like.
Yeah.
About that, from your heart, kind of, what are you feeling about that project?
You know, it's grown. It's kind of overwhelming how much it's grown over the last year. I created it because of Art Street. I would not have started that if Sacramento did not allow me to with Art Street. I think it would have always had been an idea in my head that just stayed there. So I'm so grateful for that platform. From there, it's really taken off. We've shown it internationally. We've had international press. It's gone viral in a way. And so I think it's just incredible to see that it's impacting people, that women are finally feeling heard in that regard. And I just really want to continue to make an impact as much as I can in every way possible.
Describe how it works for people who have not seen it. What would they expect to see?
Yeah, so this is what it feels like, is an interactive auditory exhibit where men can experience what it feels like to be catcalled and harassed. So men can experience what it feels like to be a female presenting person in society. And so we interview 100 women from each region that we go to, and we get men to record women's experiences. And so men are walking into this booth listening to other men catcalling them. And it's a really profound experience in seeing men coming out of the booth crying in tears, seeing women finally feeling validated. I've had 60-year-old women tell me, like, thank you, I've never felt heard. This is the first time in my life that I feel like my experiences are validated. And that's what keeps me going, to be quite honest, because it's really emotional work. But it's, you know, how can I not keep going when I hear that?
When your record Devoted came out in 2015, you said it was a heartbreak album.
Yeah.
How does it feel now to perform those songs?
To be quite honest, I feel like I've lived so many lives. Maybe we all feel that way. I feel like that was a completely different life ago. And so for me, these songs have transitioned from heartbreak to empowerment. I feel like I've gotten through that. I'm a new person. I'm a different person. I'm very grateful for that experience because it's just made me, you know, a stronger person, as cliche as that sounds. But so now when I perform them, I take them. It almost feels like I'm telling someone else's story.
Mm.
So, yeah.
How is the dynamic between you and your bandmates, Danny Fernandez?
You know, Danny Fernandez has kind of taken a step down from the writing process. And so now it's really me and Adam Pierce, who is my incredible drummer. And that's been a really beautiful transition. I feel like Rituals of Mine, Sister Crayon, everything that I've done has always had these new people coming in and out over the years. And so it's been a really incredible process working with my producer, Wes Jones, working with Adam Pierce, working with my front of house, Ira Skinner. It's developing into a new thing. And I always want to be innovative and not create the same thing twice. So I think this new record is going to really be something that you've never heard. You know, from Rituals or from me. It's going to really take it to a new level.
Sometimes you attach Polaroid photos to your instruments. When did you start doing that?
And oh, wow.
How do you decide which image goes with what instrument?
Oh, gosh, that's really cool. No one's ever asked me about that. So, yeah, I've taken Polaroids ever since I can remember, and these Polaroids are all memories of, you know, different people that have created such an impact in my life. And so my grandmother, Dana, I have a Polaroid of her on my guitar. She really was the first person that I remember, the first voice that I remember ever hearing. And it was so powerful to hear someone that I loved singing. And that's never left my memory of, you know, I think that kind of created this interest in the voice. I just try to, like, keep people in my life. It inspires me to know why I'm doing what I'm doing and where I come from.
Keeps you focused?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, my father, I also have one of my father. He passed away a few years ago, and that's just something that absolutely just keeps me going, keeps me focused, keeps me inspired, just seeing these people in my life who aren't here any longer but have made me so undeniably who I am and, you know, made me do why I'm doing it and what, you know, so yeah, sorry, I feel overwhelmed just talking about it. It's really beautiful. No one's ever asked me about that before.
So you just got back from a tour opening for Afghan Whigs and Built to Spill. How did those fans respond to you? Pretty different
right
groups.
Yeah, so I was kind of, you know, actually really timid and intimidated because I didn't know what to expect, but their crowds embraced us. It was really beautiful, and that was probably one of the best tours, if not the best, that I've done so far. Surprisingly.
That's saying something, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really great. Both bands are incredible and such sweethearts, but their fans were really open, and I think it's because, you know, music is music regardless of the genre. If it's real, people are going to feel it. And I can say that with confidence. One of the only few things I can say with confidence is that what we're doing is very genuine. It comes from a place that there's, you know, there's no pride, there's no ego. It's a very genuine performance. And so I think that resonated with people.
And you've been creating music for about 12 years now, right?
Yeah.
When you look back on the beginning and where you are and where you're headed, what do you see?
You know, I'm just so grateful for every single day that I'm able to do this, even, you know, despite how hard it can be sometimes. I think I'm in a very privileged place to be able to express myself in this medium, and I just want to continue for as long as I can, and I don't take a day of this for granted. So I see a girl who really had a lot to say and really struggled to try to find her voice in this. And now I see a woman who is, you know, still figuring myself out, but has just, you know, hard work. Over the last 12 years has been nothing but hard work. And I'm just so grateful for Sacramento's support and for everyone's support. I feel very supported. And I don't know, sometimes it makes me want to cry with just, it's huge. I never take that for granted.
You've been hinting about some new work you're doing on social media, an EP perhaps. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm very excited. We're going to be releasing it on my label, Bitchwave, and I just cannot wait. I am so excited to put this new music out there. It's been, you know, my last 3 years have been so filled with loss and death and life and love and all of these changes. And I'm so excited to be creating music that holds nothing back, that's very honest, very genuine. But at the same time, you know, I've been forcing myself to create music that I've never created before. I never want to create the same thing twice, which can be pretty scary. But at the same time, I'm very excited about it. I think our fans will be really excited about it. So, yeah, it's going to come out sooner than you think. So,
is there some particular aspect that's new about what you're doing with your music?
Absolutely. I'm working with people, you know, I'm working with my same producer, but we're pushing ourselves in a way. I'm singing in a way that I haven't. I'm expressing myself in a way that I haven't. I'm using less metaphors. I am singing very direct about how I'm feeling, what's been going on in my life. And I'm addressing things that, you know, I've never addressed before: depression, loss, love, death. I am just kind of going headfirst into those topics, and it's been very healing for me. So I hope it's, you know, healing for those who listen.
Raw stuff.
Yeah, very raw. Yeah.
Do you have a timeline for your release?
This fall, we will definitely be having new music for sure.
That is Tara Lopez with Rituals of Mind. They're headlining the R Street Block Party this Saturday from noon to 8 p.m. The lineup is fantastic. It is a free all-ages show with lots of food and music. Tara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information, check out our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan and for Beth Ruyak. The Davis Music Fest is back for its 8th consecutive year. DMF is a 3-day multi-venue, multi-genre, live music event showcasing a local, regional, and a touring artist. Joining me in studio, Executive Director of the Festival and Davis Live Music Collective, as well as being a full-time teacher and artist, Kyle Monholland. Welcome to Insight. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's just get right to it. How did the festival get started?
It started, so this is our 8th year, started 8 years ago as just a really good way to celebrate the live music scene in the area, bringing people into Davis and to raise a little bit of money for arts education in Davis Public Schools, and has gradually, you know, kept that mission but grown since then.
So most festivals have headliners. Why did you choose not to go that route?
Yeah, and it's a conscious decision. We want to make sure that that's clear, that, you know, there is a model where you can get the big names and pay the big bucks, and hopefully that brings people out. But it's a gamble, and we feel like we're really lucky to have in our region, extending that out to the Bay Area, Santa Cruz, and all the way down the coast, that we're just rich with great musical talent and really believe in our local artists and want to showcase them as best we can.
Well, let's listen to some highlights from the lineup. First, Sam Chase and the Untraditional. How did they get onto your radar before we bring that up?
So I've seen them at a number of different events and just was blown away by the great show they put on. A lot of different styles of music wrapped into their sound, but most of all, just great energy and put on a really good live show. Really happy to bring them out for our kickoff event tomorrow night, Friday.
All right, let's listen.
So dream on, little darling, soon the morning's gonna come. There are monsters in the moon. down to the shore.
So you touched on this a little bit, Kyle, but who benefits from the festival?
So the Davis School Arts Foundation is our beneficiary. They've been raising and giving grants for arts education and music education in Davis Public Schools for over 30 years. And that's actually how I found out about Music Fest, was I was on their board, mm-hmm. and we got this nice check after the first year, and it just really made sense to get more involved.
And volunteers are the key?
Volunteers are what it's all about. Everybody who puts on Music Fest from day one, year-round volunteers, day of volunteers, unless you are a performer at Fest or a sound technician, you are a volunteer.
So we have a singer-songwriter up next. Tell me about Laura Benitez and The Heartache.
Oh, a new band, to me anyway, but to the area coming out of Berkeley, kind of by way of Bakersfield with her sound. Really great roots in classic country and honky-tonk, and a really good personal story coming from kind of a mixed background and representing her her own personal story well with her music.
Here's Laura Benitez and The Heartache. Moving right along, let's talk about the jazz stage this year, one that's close to my heart. How did that come about?
Yeah, it's a new feature we added this year, and it really came out of an empathy for the end of Sacramento Jazz Fest. Tradition and longstanding, an institution that we, as organizers of our event, were sad to see go and wanted to tip our hats to that and really kind of usher in something new with a lot of new, younger jazz artists in the area and showcase that in a nice way. At a new stage.
John Hatamiya, let's take a listen to him. John Hatamiya, that's a local boy, Davis born and raised, a jazz prodigy returning to the festival with his band and a special guest to play the first ever jazz stage Saturday at the Pence Gallery on D Street. Hopefully the jazz stage will continue.
We will see.
All righty. I am speaking with Kyle Monholland, the executive director of the Davis Music Festival and Davis Live Music Collective. Davis Music Fest is, of course, an annual production of the member-supported, volunteer-run, nonprofit Davis Live Music Collective. Let's move on to the Gold Souls. Who are they?
Gold Souls, yeah, local favorites here in Sacramento. I know they've been on the show before. I believe they have been. And we're really excited to bring them into Davis to play their own brand of really fun soul, some jazz, but a lot of pop sensibilities as well.
Let's listen. And the Gold Souls have an album release, a concert next week. You can find more information on our website. So how do you pick the artists? How do artists, you know, say they'd like to be part of the Davis Festival? How does it all work?
Sure. So we actually start behind the scenes looking at our roster of alumni artists. We are really lucky at this point to have almost 200 artists who have performed at Davis Music Fest over the years. and we survey our kind of longtime fans and our board to see, hey, who do we want to have back? Who puts on a great show and who's around? Who has a new album coming out? And then we try to build around that. Also, you know, have our ears out for who's coming up, who's new. It's really, we're trying to think of it as an opportunity for discovering new things. Everybody's got their favorites, but also we want people to be willing to just roam around and listen for what's great. And, you know, whether you recognize the name or not, you're going to hear something really good.
So the Sun Monks, tell us about the Sun Monks.
Sun Monks, love the Sun Monks. They've been at Music Fest before, and they've been around town a bunch. They do their own thing. It is art and music and a really just infectious, catchy sound. And they really epitomize a lot of the artists that we like to bring in because they're just great, nice people.
Yeah, I love their vocals. I love all the layers. It's just pretty amazing. Well, we appreciate you being with us. We will be playing a little bit of the Sun Monks here as we close out the show. Kyle Monholland is the executive director of the Davis Music Festival, now in its 8th year, kicking off this week. And thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Here's the Sun Monks.
Nobody wants to leave. Is it something we can't keep? We were born to have.